There you go. We are all delighted to have Paul Krugman with us. We sometimes have that pleasure if we can catch him as he passes by. Paul is, of course, based at MIT, but he's also a long-standing member of the Center for Economic Performance here, and he tells me that he's just published another book with one of our colleagues, Tony Venables, which is going to put the economics of geography on the map. But today we're talking about more short-term critical matters. Paul, as you know, is the world's leading international economist. More of the time he does trade issues, but today he's doing macro issues. He's also a formidable economic commentator, and I think he must be, and I think you've more or less shown it, the best-known economist in the world now, probably having taken over from Milton Friedman, so it's really nice to have you here. I was about to say that the world is lucky to have Paul, because the world economy looks a bit less secure than it maybe used to, and Paul was one of the people who pointed out that the Asian miracle was less secure before it revealed itself to be so. Today he's going to celebrate the publication of his book, which is about what we have to do next. So Paul is going to talk for about 15 minutes, and you'll all find things to disagree with, and then you can ask him why you disagree with him, and we'll go on till about 7:30. Paul.
Well, thank you. Thanks, Richard. This is, I'm a little abashed, actually. I usually do spend a couple of weeks at the LSE each year, and it just hasn't worked out, and instead I'm spending a couple of hours on the course of this thing, but it's always a great pleasure to be here. The title of the book, the title of the lecture, I think, that was posted is the same as the title of the book that just got released, which is The Return of Depression Economics. And I will be talking about that, but I thought that maybe the lecture ought to have some, that there were other titles I could have used. And the one that seemed to make, to ring most with me when I was thinking about it was how and why I stopped being sensible. And I'm really going to talk about that subject. I think that's probably the best way to explain what it's all about. Because until pretty recently, I was very sensible. In fact, if there was an accusation that people levied against me, it was that there was too little radical stuff in what I had to say, that it was that I was mostly defending continuing business as usual, and that my basic view was that we had a basically workable framework for running the world economy. It could always stand improvement, but I thought we had the basics more or less under control. And what I've now learned, I think I've learned, from the events of the last 2 years and from some hard thinking about those events, is that it isn't quite as much under control as we thought it was. That's probably an understatement. That it turns out that some problems that we thought were well, that sensible people like I used to be, thought were well under control, well resolved, are in fact not at all well resolved, that we're much more vulnerable than we thought we were. And the way I'm going to structure this talk is to start with the world as I imagined it to be, the world as I think this mainstream opinion, mainstream informed opinion still imagines it to be, and then talk about the reasons why I think it's not actually quite that way. For a starting point, I often find that rather than talking in terms of the actual world economy out there, it's helpful to start with something that's a little bit easier to wrap your mind around, and it's a parable. Anybody who's read some of my earlier books or who's read this book, which is not on sale in the bookstores until tomorrow, but is on sale in cyberspace and has been for a while. Anybody who's read this book or some of my other writings is familiar with this, but there's a parable which happens to be a true story that is very central to my view about the way the world works. And it is the parable or the true story contained in a wonderful 1977 article in the Journal of Money, Credit, and Banking by Joan and Richard Sweeney, which was entitled Monetary Theory and the Great Capitol Hill Babysitting Co-op Crisis. And let me tell you the story, true story, with a lot of implications. The story is that of a babysitting co-op. It's a fairly common thing. Young couples with children who are a little bit short on cash make an arrangement to sit each other's babies. On nights when some couples want to go out for the evening, some other couple will look after their children as well as their own children. And in general, such schemes when benefit from having a reasonably large number of people involved, so that the chance that you will find a match between the people who are willing to stay at home and the people who are going out is reasonably large. But if there is more than a couple of couples involved, such a scheme requires some system to make sure that the burden is fairly shared. And it actually turns out that the scheme that these people's co-op adopted is fairly common, which is a script system. You have something, in their case, it was actually little printed coupons that said 1 hour of babysitting time. But I know of one in Massachusetts that uses lollipop sticks. But in any case, there are little units of account that are issued. And basically, when in this babysitting co-op that's described in the article, which is about 150 couples, all of whom were in one way or another associated with U.S. congressional operations, Capitol Hill babysitting co-op crisis. When there was babysitting taking place, the baby sittees would hand the appropriate number of coupons to the babysitters. Okay, so it would be an automatically self-enforcing system. You would automatically, over time, end up doing as much babysitting as you received from other people. And so clever use of a little monetary system to make the thing work. Well, the co-op got into a problem, and the way the problem worked was this. If you're going to do this, you have to have some reserve of coupons in circulation. So they when people joined it, they were issued with some hours of babysitting time. What they didn't understand, at least at first, was that there is actually a certain average reserve of coupons that people would want to hold. Sometimes you'd want to babysit, but other times you might want to go out for several nights in succession, and you might not have another opportunity to babysit. And over the intervening time, you might you'd want to hold enough reserve that if you had to go out several nights before your next time that you were able to earn some more coupons, you would be able to do that. And it turned out that the coupons issued were, there's a lot of details that are not relevant here, but the coupons issued were not sufficient in number. There were not enough coupons out there to provide people with the average reserve that they wanted to hold. The result of this was a little peculiar. Couples were reluctant to go out because they wanted to save their coupons for special important occasions, which meant, since one couple's decision to go out was another couple's opportunity to babysit, that opportunities to babysit were scarce, which made people even more reluctant to go out. And, okay, right? The babysitting co-op got itself into a recession. And it being an organization, this is Capitol Hill, so mostly lawyers. At first, the economic staffers, although the economic staffers quickly caught on what the problem was, they had trouble convincing the governing board, and they tried to deal with it by, with a rule requiring couples to go out at least twice a month and so on. But in the end, eventually they persuaded people that the. It was a monetary problem, and more coupons were issued, and it was magical. People became more willing to go out, it became easier to get opportunities to babysit, and the GBP, the gross babysitting product, soared. And it doesn't actually have a happy ending, because then they overdid it, and then there started to be problems of incipient inflation and so on. But the all right, now this is it's a true story, and it is a perfect, it's the smallest, I think, conceivable macroeconomy. And what it experienced was a true recession. What it experienced was a true recovery. The big economy, this was a real economy, but the big one out there is a lot more complicated than that. instead of producing one product, which is baby's set, it produces millions of products, and we have financial markets. People are able to borrow and lend their coupons, but it is, in my view, this is the basic story about what happens how an economy can suffer from a recession due to inadequate demand, and how monetary policy can, used well, be a very good thing. And it has two important, two morals or two important implications, which are very much a part of what sensible, civilized people believe about economic policy. The first is that it is possible for bad things to happen to good economies. What went wrong in the babysitting co-op was not that it suffered from Capitol Hill values or crony babysittingism, or that there was something wrong that they were inefficient babysitters or anything like that. Obviously, the quality of babysitting matters. The co-op could fail because people were just doing a very bad job of taking care of other people's children. But this problem, anyway, was simply a failure of adequate demand. And what that tells you is, in a way, it tells you that supply-side economics is wrong, that if you believe that only the supply side matters, that supply creates its own demand, that is not necessarily true. It says that Say's law, for those who follow these things, Say's law ain't necessarily so. It says that the common view, what I often refer to as the hangover theory, the view that when you have an economic slump, it's a punishment for your past sins, that the reason you have an economic slump, you have to have that slump because of past excesses, is wrong. It says that the view that that economic pain is good for you is usually wrong. That it's not true that what a depressed economy needs to do is to actually Schumpeter used the phrase let the work of depression take place. Depression isn't doing a work. It isn't preparing you for the future. It is in fact a screw up. It's too few coupons chasing too many people who want to babysit. So on the one side, it says the Keynesianism is right. There really is a possible, failures of demand are a real possibility. But on the other hand, while Keynesianism is right, what I think of as vulgar Keynesianism is wrong. And that's the other piece of it, which is very important to my worldview. If you think about that depressed babysitting co-op, when there weren't enough coupons, when there wasn't enough spending, that was a world in which it was an Alice through the Looking Glass universe. It was a world in which virtues became vices. It's a world in which, or babysitting co-op, but it could be the world as a whole, in which prudent couples, people deciding to save for a rainy day, the people who were willing to babysit and willing to defer gratification on going out were actually doing positive damage to their society, in which thrift was a bad thing. It was a world in which if the governing board of the co-op had been willing to pay people in the form of coupons to do absolutely pointless things, been willing to pay people to stay home and babysit rag dolls or something, that would have actually been a good thing. A completely unproductive activity would have been beneficial as long as it generated spending and made people more willing than to go out and spend their coupons. Vulgar Keynesianism is the belief that that's the way things normally are. It is the view that saving is bad and spending is good, and that government deficits are essential because that's how you keep people spending enough. And it's a view that ever since Keynes has always had followers. And the reason it's wrong, according to the babysitting co-op story, and the reason it's normally wrong in the real world, is, hey, there is a simple technical answer. Just issue more coupons. The reason vulgar Keynesianism is wrong is not that failures of aggregate demand don't happen, but that monetary policy solves them. And that means that because that's the solution, that the solution to the real economic problem, you have to have adequate demand management, but then the real economic problem is how do I increase the available supply? So it's because we have a solution to the, if you like, to the macroeconomic problem that microeconomics is the really deep problem. It's not because the invisible hand of Adam Smith solves all problems. It's because the visible hand of Alan Greenspan solves those particular problems that we can let the invisible hand go to work on the rest of them. And what that leads you to And it's the it is the ideology of that I believe, still basically believe in, but not quite as firmly as I want to. The basic view is, which is the view that civilized, sensible people have, is what I would call free market Keynesianism. It's you believe that markets are a wonderful thing, but you that is contingent on believing that you have the tools, the monetary policy that prevents sustained sustained recessions, sustained slumps due to simply inadequate spending. And up until 2 years ago, I was quite convinced of that view, with just a couple of caveats that I didn't regard as very serious. One caveat, which only economists worry about, is that price flexibility could invalidate that argument. If you really thought that, look, what's going to happen in the real world is that if there are people wanting to babysit but not able to find the opportunity, they'll offer to do it for only 0.8 of a coupon instead of one coupon. And if everybody does that, then the real value of the coupons increases, and that solves the problem. You don't need to have a central bank managing the economy. That question, why isn't that true, took economics off on a grand 20-year detour, which left us believing that because we didn't have a good answer to why that doesn't happen, therefore failures of aggregate demand, even though they're plainly visible to the naked eye, can't really be happening. That's a terribly important thing if you're trying to get at the deep foundations of the subject, but I don't think an important issue for practical concerns. The other is a much more real world issue, which is if you are not an economy in isolation, you are an economy that has a national currency and you are worried about the exchange rate of that currency against other currencies, then you may not be free to print coupons as you like. And the answer from somebody who wants to be a free market Keynesian is, well, that means that trying to defend an exchange rate is sacrificing a very important piece of economic policy. And while clearly you don't want Cambridge, Massachusetts to have its own currency with a floating exchange rate, it leads you to a certain bias towards flexible exchange rates so that you have the monetary policy so that you become free to be a free market advocate elsewhere. And I guess people are aware that this obviously has a bearing on the whole euro issue, which has taken on a political dimension here that doesn't at all have on the other side of the Atlantic, where people who would be progressive third way types say also tend to be floating exchange rate types because they believe in the importance of being able to have this aggressive anti-unemployment policy, that they believe that you want to be able to issue coupons if you are in a slump. Until very recently, I think at this point still most of my colleagues still regard those two caveats aside, regard it as being fairly straightforward. That the answer, the point is, yes, we do have, there is a possibility of failures of demand. It's possible to have a situation in which more people want to babysit than want to go out. But it's possible for that to happen because although Alan Greenspan may be omnipotent, he's not omniscient, and he doesn't always get the supply of coupons right. But those are basically short-term bobbles that you can have a screw up like the one that happened in the U.S. in the early 90s, where aggregate demand is allowed to fall too low. But by and large, the basic rule is that there's a simple dial to adjust to make sure that the economy is has enough demand. If anything, the enduring problem is that the temptation to issue too many coupons. And so basically the demand side problem is solved. Well, for me, the revelation, which I think we all should have been more sensitive to, but the revelation of the last couple of years has been that it's not that easy. And in fact, some of the ways that the world has changed, ways that are good in many respects, have actually substantially increased the risk that we can find ourselves in a situation where we either can't issue the coupons, can't fight the recessions, or we try and it doesn't work. And the title of the book, The Return of Depression Economics, is saying, hey, these problems which we thought were solved, the problem of the Alice through the Looking Glass economy where virtue is vice and vice is virtue, and where persistent inadequate demand becomes a central economic problem, that world is back. It's not back everywhere, but it is back. Now, what are the things that led me to that? You might think that it would be the great Asian financial crisis, and certainly that's an important part of it. But what bothers me about the Asian crisis is not so much the devastation wreaked. I mean, obviously that's the humanitarian side, that's the thing that matters most immediately, but the way it happened. If you measure the economic difficulties of the last 2 years by their impact on world growth, this is actually not anywhere close to the biggest crisis we've had since the 30s. Both oil crises had a bigger impact on world growth. Even the gratuitous slowdown that the industrial countries had at the beginning of the 90s had a slightly bigger impact on world growth. But this time, it was the crisis, which I think, well, I'll talk about why I don't think it's over. This crisis is much more gratuitous than those previous ones. It's much more driven by demand failures. It reveals to an extent that the previous crises did not the ineffectuality of our normal policy instruments. So this is a bit like, it's as if a disease that you thought was well controlled has staged a new outbreak in a form resistant to the antibiotics that we currently have. Maybe not a lot of people have actually been killed by that disease. The truth is more people are dying from smoking and overeating than they are from this disease. But the fact that ancient plague has reappeared and that the medication that we had on the shelf isn't working is what scares me. And what scares me particularly is what upsets me is that having spent a good deal of time slapping down vulgar Keynesianism, we now have some cases in which the vulgar Keynesianism looks right. I don't think it is right. I think there are better answers, but in which some of these old-fashioned the world is inverted stories start to make sense. Now, there are really two main parts to that, and let me start with the less dramatic, but I think in some ways more important piece, which is what is happening, what has happened in Japan, which is. For me, the scariest place economically, the scariest place on Earth. Not because Japan is a terrible place to be, not because there's about to be mass starvation or riots in the street. It's a rich country with unemployment that's very high by their standards, but nothing like mass unemployment, no breadlines. What's scary about Japan is that this is a country that has all of the advantages. This is a country that is rich, stable politically, is not heavily in debt to the rest of the world. Is by contrast, in fact, it's the world's largest creditor. It has all of the freedom of action that a country could reasonably want, and yet it finds itself in really. In the eighth or ninth, depending on how you count it, year of a sustained slump, having pushed conventional policies to their limits, running the largest peacetime budget deficits in history, the short-term interest rate is 0.02%, and it's not recovering. Now that sentence it demands a qualification given the rather strange numbers that were announced. Recently in Japan, and there is an amazing surge reported in the first quarter, and maybe that will turn out to be the beginning of some change. But my experience, I've been around seeing a lot of recoveries. My experience is that the informal evidence, the stuff that the guys in the people who are watching sales in stores, people who are taking consumer surveys, that always signals a dramatic recovery before it shows in the official statistics. I've never heard of one where the official statistics show a boom that none of the other indicators are reporting, and it turns out to be right. So I'm not making accusations here. There's something wrong with that number. But anyway, let me continue with Japan as I still think it is. The crucial thing about Japan is that, at least in normal terms, the coupon issuing has gone as far as it can. Now, in the real world, governments don't usually hand out coupons. Well, actually, the Japanese government has handed out some coupons, but the way you get money into the system is not by simply handing it out to people. You do it through open market operations. There's a money market. There's an interest rate. And the way that you set monetary policy, even if you have some sort of money supply target, approximately the way you set it is by setting an interest rate target. And the Japanese have pushed it absolutely to the limit. Short-term interest rates are essentially zero. And yet, that's not expanding the economy. It's not apparently fighting off deflationary pressures. How can that be? That is sort of challenging a fundamental tenet of the faith I had a couple of years ago, which was that monetary policy can always deal with this sort of problem. My actual sequence on this was I said to myself, look, maybe the interest rate is zero, but if they expanded the money supply enough, it would still produce an economic recovery. And I sat down to write myself a buttoned-down, crossed I's and dotted T's, mathematical model to prove that increasing the money supply always works. And the model didn't tell me what I wanted to hear. It actually said, maybe it doesn't. Then having that fairly abstract thing, for the economists in the crowd, with intertemporal optimization and all that, I then boiled it down to something a little simpler and closer to what you'd find in your ordinary intermediate textbook. And finally, in the process of explaining to myself why I was not able to get the conclusions I wanted, I went back to the babysitting co-op. Realized that even implicit in that story is the possibility that issuing coupons is not always going to work. And here's a version of it for which that's true. Let's now, if you want, we can sort of make this a sort of souped-up fancy co-op in which you can actually borrow and lend coupons, since there is an interest rate out there. And let's imagine now that there's also, in this souped-up babysitting co-op, there turns out to be a seasonality in people's preferences. During the winter, when it's cold and dark, people are relatively happy to stay at home and look after other people's children. But during the summer, they'd like to go out into the long hours of daylight and the balmy summer evenings. And so your typical couple would like to accumulate coupons in the winter. And spend them in the summer. Well, they can't all do that. If everyone tries to do that, then they discover that there are just not enough people going out in the winter to meet the demand or better still, the supply of babysitting. If they all collectively try to do that, what you're going to have is a winter recession. And you're going to have that winter recession even if you make the interest, even if you lend people coupons at a zero interest rate. Because what people want to do in aggregate is they want to carry over winter babysitting to summer nights out, even at a price of one for one. They have no desire to borrow things for winter babysitting and then repay them in the summer. No way. Even at a zero interest rate, it won't work. In fact, even if you went out and just handed people extra coupons in the winter, planning to recollect them as dues in the summer, it wouldn't work if people understood that was what you were doing, because they say, well, I have to lay in an extra reserve to pay this special tax that's going to be levied on me in the summer. Well, you have what I've just given you as an informal babysitting level explanation of how you can be in a liquidity trap, which is what Japan is in, a situation where a zero interest rate is not low enough. What's the answer? Well, there is a natural answer here. Really, what we're saying here is that the price is wrong. In fact, what people believe that they can carry over winter babysitting to summer nights out at a price of 1 for 1, but collectively they can't. That is the wrong price. And the only way to bring the supply of babysitting and the demand for babysitting into line with each other would be to get that price right, to say, look, you can only convert 1 hour of winter babysitting into 50 minutes of summer time out. Well, there's a word for that, and it's called inflation. The value of a coupon in terms of babysitting, the people would have to expect that the value of a coupon in terms of babysitting would fall between winter and summer. And that's the chain of logic I followed, and came down to the conclusion that one way to say this is to say that it's still true that increasing the supply of coupons always solves a demand problem, but only if people believe that you're increasing not only today's supply of coupons but tomorrow's. And the reason why monetary policy is ineffective in Japan is that people believe that the Bank of Japan, however much it may increase the money supply now, will not sustain that. That they will try in the future to keep the price level from rising, and therefore that they will not. People believe that the coupons, that the money that they get today, is basically just a loan at a rate that doesn't make them want to take it. I'm not saying this. Let me say it. The way that it finally comes out, it comes down to a credibility problem. It comes down to a belief that the monetary expansion will not be sustained. It comes down to actually believing that whatever it might say or do, the central bank will be responsible in the future. And that's the problem. There's no credible belief that the monetary expansion is one that will continue even if it produces inflation. Now, this is actually, it's a very straightforward argument, and it can be done a bunch of different ways. But it says right away that this problem that we have in Japan is showing the limits of our conventional views of what is adequate policy. That here we have a sustained, very severe shortage of demand. I would argue that Japan is at least 10% below its productive capacity. There are official numbers that are much smaller than that, but the way that they're constructed automatically reinterprets any sustained slump as a slowdown in potential output. And we're finding that over-the-counter remedies, the aspirin, doesn't work. I'm claiming that there is actually a prescription drug that would solve the problem, but in any case, we're finding that the conventional remedy doesn't work. Now, when I started to talk about these views, and there are related, not quite the same proposed, but other people have been proposing radical monetary expansion, what I found was that looking at the way people responded to this was a very radicalizing experience. Let me explain what I mean by that. Here you've got what is, at a fundamental level, very straightforward economics. It's a very conventional model applied to a very unusual situation, and it is therefore implying an unusual policy answer. That's what conventional models are for. If they only tell you to do what you always were doing, then they're not much good. The whole point is that they should tell you sometimes to do something you didn't expect, because you've got an understanding of the way the world works. Well, it turns out that not everybody, but many people actually don't arrive at their views about economic policy that way. Instead of having a basic model of an understanding of the way the world works, which they use to arrive at their policy conclusions, turns out that they know what policies they want, and they're prepared on the fly to make up whatever model they can think of that would justify them. And if the standard textbook model says that price stability is, while it may be a good thing in most circumstances, is actually not at all what you need in this case, then let's try to find some other reasons why price stability is a good idea here. And there have been all sorts of explanations here. Basically, they all come to one way or another saying that in this particular case, although nowhere else supply curve slope down, demand curve slope up, that inflation, although it reduces the price of current goods instead of future goods, will nonetheless lead people to spend less, not more. That we take the sacred principle of stable prices and look for justifications rather than taking our sacred model and taking its implications. Be a little more concrete. I want to talk about the fundamental weirdness of what is the orthodox approach to policy in Japan and emerging in other places. We regard it as responsible and respectable to close a gap between desired savings and desired investment by having the government engage in massive dissaving. While it is irresponsible and crazy to reduce the price so that supply and demand get matched. It's a little bit like saying that in the face of a surplus of wheat, the responsible, respectable thing is to go and burn some of the wheat. And it would be a very dangerous and crazy policy to actually let the price of wheat fall. And yet that is the way that the practical policy measures are justified. Now, there was one other piece of the discussion of Japan and of liquidity trap economies in general that unfortunately was a serious objection. And that was, well, if the Japanese tried to do as you are suggesting, the yen would plunge, and that would undermine the confidence of investors in all of Asia and set in motion another round of financial crisis. And unfortunately, that was, I think it less so now, but that's a very valid objection. But what does that say? It says that it gets you to the other half of the return of depression economics, which is saying that we have reached a world in which we are terrified of the flows of hot money, sufficiently terrified that we're allowing that we feel constrained in dealing with other very fundamental economic problems. Now, I'm less sure of my ground here because I think we're not as certain that I know what the answers are here, but at least I know what the questions are. So let me go as far as I can. Currency crises are nothing new. The economic students here know that I've been doing them for a very long time. We know that if a government is pursuing policies that are fundamentally inconsistent with a fixed exchange rate, there will eventually be a speculative attack. We know that if a government is under some political pressure to devalue, that there's a possibility that a self-fulfilling attack will take place, that people will start to speculate against the currency and in so doing force the government's hand. We even know that we knew before this crisis that it was possible in principle that large economic agents could engineer a speculative run on a currency for fun and profit. Several years ago I suggested a generic term for those large economic agents, which was soroi, which is that we now reach the limits of my Greek. But up until a few years ago, while currency crises clearly occurred, and while they were very upsetting things to the governments that faced them, what you could say is that it was an issue that was not of a lot of economic moment. Because what happened when you had a currency crisis was typically the finance minister lost his job, and the government was very embarrassed, and the economy that was the subject of the attack actually did reasonably well, if anything benefited. And the classic example is, of course, Sterling 92. While Mr. Lamont was singing in the bath, but wasn't for very long, judging from what happened over the next couple of years, should have put up another pedestal in Trafalgar Square with George Soros on it to thank him for what was done. Now, there was one big exception, which was the tequila crisis in Mexico in 95, in which a devaluation forced by a speculative run on the currency, instead of being followed by the market saying, oh, good, that's over, and an economic recovery was instead followed by a catastrophic economic implosion. I didn't take it seriously enough. Nobody took it seriously enough, except maybe Guillermo Calvo at Maryland was the lone voice at many a conference saying, what happened there? Why was the punishment so great compared with the crime? We all took it as being a Mexican thing. New Mexico has a crisis every 6 years. That was their crisis. We took it as, and we also took the fact that it was, although brutal, rather short, as evidence that we basically knew how to deal with these things. And of course, it didn't turn out to be that way. It turned out that the tequila crisis was a dress rehearsal for the much bigger crisis in Southeast Asia, which seemed to indicate, certainly does indicate, that for many countries, my cheerful answer to the question of how does an open economy deal with the babysitting co-op problem doesn't work. That while the United States or the UK or the Eurozone or Japan, if it didn't have a liquidity trap, can just print coupons to deal with a shortfall of demand, other countries find that letting the exchange rate drop rather than freeing them up instead leads to catastrophe. Now, we don't. This is a case where analysis really has been running behind events. My best understanding now of why that is has to do with really fairly what should be fairly narrow technical things that turn out to be terribly important. It is the fact that so many countries have both highly leveraged financial structures, banks, but also corporations that have a lot of debt relative to their equity, and the fact that a significant part of that debt is in foreign currency, usually in dollars. And what happens when that's the case is that when the country is faced with a speculative attack, when it's faced with a run on the currency, there are no good options. If you let the currency drop, then the balance sheets of firms are wiped out because the dollar, that dollar debt suddenly becomes much larger in baht or in ringgit. If you try to defend the currency, which means raising interest rates, then the same firms are busted because of the interest burden. And that creates, that means that we have this normal channel of adjustment ruled out. It means that countries become very vulnerable to speculative attacks that can just come out of the blue. Something can make the market panic, and that panic can generate an economic crisis that validates the panic. Now, since I wrote this book, which I guess unless you robbed the booksellers and bought it from Amazon, you don't have yet. But since I wrote the book basically in January and February, and since then we've had one terrifically encouraging thing, which is that a major developing country has been forced into devaluation by speculative attack. And it didn't play like Mexico. It didn't play like Thailand. It played like Britain, and that's Brazil. The Brazilian story, to my surprise and relief, has turned out to be one in which the speculative attack that succeeded in January has turned out to be the best thing that's happened to them in years. And that's good to know. It says I was wrong. The funny thing is that if I believed my own model, I would have predicted that, and I just couldn't bring myself to believe that. Everybody knows that Latin Americans always do worse at these things than Asians, right? And I just couldn't bring myself to believe that although the numbers said that Brazil's financial structure was less vulnerable, that somehow it would work out fine for Brazil, but it has. And so it isn't universal. But it does say that a large part of the world doesn't have the option of devaluation and therefore doesn't have the ability to fight inadequate demand and therefore is subject to depression economics. What are the policy implications of that? Suppose that that's true. Now, one answer would be don't get there in the first place. Try to not have a highly leveraged financial structure. Try to not have that dollar debt. And that would be a very good idea. But suppose you have gotten there, and then what? One answer that is very has a lot of vehement advocates is what you do is you avert the speculative attack by making a very firm commitment that you will never, ever allow the currency to fall. And you do that by imposing a currency board or, better yet, dollarizing or euroizing will become an option, I guess, in a little while. It is an answer It's not a very good answer. If you look at what's happening in the currency board economies right now, it is depressing in both the emotional and the literal sense. What's happening in Argentina right now is that while the peg is probably not in danger, the economy is suffering a fairly nasty recession about which it can do nothing. In fact, in order to reassure people about the sanctity of the peg, it's pursuing at the same time they can do nothing with monetary policy, it's actually following a contractionary fiscal policy. So it probably isn't catastrophic, but it certainly is showing that here's an economy where inadequate demand is a big problem and will be for a long time to come. Hong Kong is a bit of a different story because they really have the problem of being in the wrong place and have very few options available. But I don't think that it certainly isn't a panacea. It doesn't solve the problem. I guess everybody knows. Last summer, watching this demand side contraction and the inability of Asian countries to fight it with any sort of monetary or fiscal policy in the opposite direction because of fear of speculators, and watching the discussion of how to save Japan stymied because you feared that doing anything would unleash another wave of speculative attacks on the rest of Asia. In some despair, I said, well, look, there is a way to cut through this knot, and it is to actually impose some controls on the flight of capital as a temporary emergency measure. The truth is that almost everybody agrees with something like this in principle, though they may not understand that that's what they agree. Almost everybody thinks that the standstill that Korea negotiated with its creditors in January of 98, which is probably one of the reasons why they are first out of the slump, was a good thing. But although it turns out that in their case, bank loans were the major channel of capital flight, once you've agreed that you do need to do something to limit the flight, why should it only apply to banks? So there is a principle there. It turned out that the timing was such that it probably was unnecessary, that the panic was subsiding just about the time that I advocated capital controls and that independently Prime Minister Mahathir actually implemented them. On the other hand, it has not turned out to be the disaster that many people feared. And the issue will arise again. And it needs to say, well, okay, we got through this one without capital controls is not an answer because it will arise again. If we're going to have some way of fighting this, we're going to have to either have the capital controls or some good alternative. And I actually don't think there is a good alternative. If I'm using the drug analogy, this is saying aspirin doesn't work. Even the stronger prescription drugs don't work. Now we're talking about chemotherapy. I don't like capital controls, but I think they are a real something you really do need to take seriously. Let me talk about the world as it now is and where I think things are going. There's been a fair bit of good news in the last 6 months, which is probably bad for my sales because even though I don't actually predict a depression, that the word is there in the title and that looks a little bit more remote than it did at the time I was writing it. The really big good news, I think, is the Brazilian story, because that's news about how the world works, and it suggests that the problem of the emerging market financial crisis is less generic and more specific than I feared it was. The recovery that's going on in Asia is, to my mind, very good, but not as much of a change in my view of the way the world works. And let me give you something to be nervous about. Let me say that one way of looking at what's happening in Asia right now is there is a pretty good recovery by all the smaller Asian countries that were hit by the crisis, which is possible because their currencies are very competitive against the overvalued currencies of the two great Asian economies, both of which are suffering from severe deflationary pressures. Because the funny thing about China is that if you actually look at the nature of their problems, they don't look anything like the problems that Thailand or Indonesia or South Korea had. They look a lot like the problems that Japan has. And if that's your view, if that's the way it looks to you, then you would say, well, you know, China and Japan are under some pressure here. And if they, actually either whether if they take my advice or if they don't, but either way, if we're talking about a major prospective falls in the yuan and the yen, there's certainly some question about whether this recovery we're now seeing can go on. If you go around the rest of the world, there are some pretty serious, there are stories you can tell. Obviously, the U.S. is a very ebullient economy with a stock market that is even more ebullient than any calculation I've seen can justify. There's a risk there. Now, if you'd asked me 2 years ago what happens if the irrational exuberance goes away, the answer would be, well, a lot of paper losses, but you know the real economy, we can handle that. Greenspan cuts interest rates, and that solves the problem. And that's probably the way it will play. But we now know, I think we now know because of Japan, that it isn't necessarily the way it will play. That liquidity traps are not a mythical beast from the past. They are very much a real live possibility in the modern world. And if you have, we now forget very easily. We forget that in the fall of last year, we had a financial crisis in the U.S. That was short-lived and never did quite reach the real economy, but that was absolutely terrifying when it was in progress. We had a collapse of liquidity. We had, in effect, a bank run, except that it didn't involve anything that was called a bank. And that was the problem, that while we have a very well-protected banking system, our financial system now mostly bypasses those banks, and it really doesn't have the safeguards. We got out of it. Alan Greenspan cut interest rates. And there was no necessary reason why that should work. I mean, if nobody can borrow, and liquidity had just dried up, if nobody can borrow, what difference does it make what interest rate you can't borrow at? But it changed the morale. And it was really a situation. The army was about to break, and General Greenspan rode out in front on his horse and waved his sword around and shouted something encouraging and rallied the troops. And it was very well done. It was heroically done. And I am very nervous about a financial system that relies on heroes to save it. And I found that a very nerve-wracking thing. Last point is on where the world is Europe, and Europe is, the Eurozone is sputtering along. It's better than I feared it might be. The ECB has been a little more expansionary than we feared it might be. But let me put it this way, there are two ways to think about Japan's problem, not necessarily mutually exclusive. One is that it's a story of the bubble that burst and plunged the economy into a trap from which it has been unable to escape. The other is that it's a story of a country with a radically aging population, shrinking working age population, which therefore just has too much saving and not enough investment demand. And therefore, unless it had followed very expansionary monetary policies, would find itself in the kind of trap it's now in, where the bubble economy really just delayed that crisis. The first story sounds kind of like America. The second story kind of sounds like Europe. So as the French would say, it's an all azimuths threat. It's whichever way you look at it, there you can be worried about some large part of the rest of the advanced world. Last thing, I am talking too long, which is not normal. But last thing, how did we get into this mess? How did we get into this very dangerous place? The answer, I think, is that we got in here because of the things we did right, not the things we did wrong. The reason why the liquidity trap is now a very live and very frightening issue is first and foremost because we fought such a successful battle against inflation. Because we brought the world from a situation of 8% expected inflation and 11% interest rates to one of no expected inflation and 2 or 3% interest rates in Europe, and probably expected deflation and zero interest rates in Japan, we've created a world in which central banks don't necessarily have enough room to fight recessions. We did something that was a good thing, but we took it to the point where it recreated some old problems. We used to have a world of exchange controls, which were a source of vast inefficiency, corruption. We pulled them away. We made the world economy more efficient. We also opened up the possibility of massive speculative attacks that do massive economic damage. And the danger that hasn't actually done a lot of harm yet because of the heroic action of Greenspan is we took a overregulated, sluggish, sleepy, bank-centered financial system and opened it up through deregulation to a much more flexible system that does a much better job of getting the capital to where it needs to be and leaves us wide open to the kind of financial crises that only our grandfathers remember. It is, I guess the short summary is that we took the world, we recreated many of the virtues of the world economy before the Great Depression. And in so doing, I think we have recreated some of the vulnerabilities that made that depression possible. The answer is to move the dials back a little bit, not to go back to situations in which countries have exchange controls and 14 different exchange rates, and the easiest way to make money is to bribe somebody to reclassify a good at a more favorable exchange rate, but to move back to a world in which there is, just as an abstract thing, suggests that maybe you should have a 2.5% inflation target, symmetric, rather than price stability, a world where there are some restrictions, mild ones that limit capital mobility, and you hold the reserve of more draconian restrictions if necessary. And I've never been any good at financial supervision issues. I don't know exactly how you regulate these the new financial markets, but I think we do need to do something. It's a scary world. And for me, it's even scarier because things are looking better at the moment. I remember too well how my friends and I all felt vindicated, secure, reassured in 1996 as Mexico emerged from its slump. And we said, oh, good, we went through that. There aren't going to be any more like that, and we know how to deal with these kinds of things. And then, as I said, that was a dress rehearsal for something much worse. The scariest thing to me right now in the world is the complacency that's settling in because the sky didn't fall last year, which may guarantee that it does one of these years, sometime soon. Thanks.
I'll take him from here. Yeah.
Okay. Who would like to start?
Speak really loud.
Yeah. You know something? Everybody else has doffed their jackets, and I'm sitting up here very uncomfortable in probably the hottest place in the room. Well, we can do that too. And then on to Chippendales. No. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
Where am I going wrong if I follow the following thought experiment with regard to Japan? If I say to myself, okay, I agree that the main problem with Japan is a lack of consumption and a lack of aggregate demand, but I say to myself, if the return on financial assets is made negative, I'm going to make real assets more attractive, but I'm also going to reduce my current income from my stock of savings, and I'm going to reduce my expected return on those stock of savings in the future, and therefore I want to save more today and spend less today.
It's at least possible. That's amounts to saying that the supply curve of savings is backward bending. And that's just possible. It is possible, but remember, there is also a demand for savings. There's investment. There is the trade balance. What I would argue is that part of the problem Japan has, which is that it can't get the yen weak enough. That sounds funny, but it really is true that you can see they're fighting it right now. If I were really going to say what do I believe, if I think of this as a, I want to go to the blackboard, right? But if I think of this as savings and investment, if you say to me that the supply of savings is possibly backward bending, I'd say, yeah, that could be. I doubt it, but it's possible. if you tell me that the excess demand for savings, the difference between the or the excess supply, that the difference between the demand for savings in the form of investment both at home and abroad doesn't respond to the rate of return enough to offset that backward bending, then I'd say, well, you know, that's really hard to believe. We almost always find that's saying that really we have a market where everything is perverse. What we normally think is that saving is relatively insensitive to the rate of return, and what we think is that investment is quite sensitive to the rate of return. And I think that's enough to give us my policy going in the right direction. If not, it's hard to think of anything that will work.
Louis Turner, thank you very much. Can't you argue you're putting too much emphasis on Japan? Can't you argue that Japan is just a special case, a sui generis? It's a sort of, you know, a queer culture, which doesn't like taking unpleasant decisions, stumbled into a speculative crisis, corporate structure which is very unfocused, has lost out very badly to Anglo-American sort of, you know, corporate strategies over the last 20 years. But that everybody knows that a massive restructuring has still got to take place at the corporate level, the sort of stuff that the British and the Americans were doing 20 years ago. Hence, nobody's going to spend any serious money on anything. And so, yes, I mean, obviously, you've got to get the inflationary expectations going, et cetera. But that, in fact, I mean, there are really no lessons from Japan for the States, maybe a little bit for sort of countries like Germany. Isn't Japan just, you know, really a case to just in its own right?
Well, that's certainly, a few people have accused me of sort of, a Nipponized view of the world. And it's, let me say a few things about that. The first is that even with all these structural problems, you're not supposed to have a problem creating demand. Those are all normally reasons why expanding demand leads to inflation instead of growth. But it's not normally a reason why you have deflation you can't fight. And so there's still something very deeply disturbing. Beyond that, it's not 20 years since we regarded the Japanese as being 10 feet tall and a role model for the rest of the world. It's 6 years. It's a very short time. And I think that what we've done now is, given that they have a lousy business cycle performance, have
recast everything about their system as being wrong. It could be that today's snap judgment about Japan is right, and the one that we had 6 years ago was absolutely wrong. Or it could be that you always find reasons why countries deserve everything that goes wrong with them. The thought experiment, two thought experiments that I would make is, number one, the Sushil's calculations from last fall turn out to be right, and the U.S. stock market takes a or the Fed's calculations turn out to be right, and the stock market takes a really big hit, and the U.S. experiences a recession and maybe gets at least spends a while on a liquidity trap. That's to give you that story, or take the story in which I think is harder to imagine, but imagine that the $300 billion of capital inflow that the U.S. currently experiences each year turns into $1 trillion of capital outflow, which is scaled by the economy as what happened to the Asian crisis countries. In either of those cases, the U.S. economy would be in very, very serious shape. And retrospectively, we'd find all kinds of reasons why it was deserved and why the prosperity of the late 90s was bogus, the roaring 90s and all of that. And I think it's much too facile now to just say, oh, deep structural problems in Japan, they need to be more like the Americans. There are a lot of ways in which they do, but Japan's bubble economy, U.S. bubble economy in the 20s, it looks much too similar to just write it off that way. I hope we're immune, but I don't believe it.
First, do you think the Brazilian economic recovery may be temporary, and why or why not? And secondly, if you really have an economic recession in Argentina, it can bring the Brazilian economy down. And
okay. The second one is easy to answer. Argentina is not that big a country. And certainly not a large part of Brazil's Brazil's gross product is exports to Argentina. It's very hard to see. Barring some kind of psychological contagion, it's just not big enough. So Argentina is in a lot of trouble, but I don't think that's a big issue for Brazil. Some Brazilian industries, obviously, but I don't think it's a big issue. The Brazilian case, as I see it now, is the big vulnerability in Brazil is actually, we also have a relief in talking about the Brazilian case, even before it turned out that things were going better than you thought, because it was a more transparent thing. Brazil has a government budget problem. The government budget problem is driven in large part by short-term debt which pays very high interest rates. And when there's a loss of confidence, the interest rates spike up, which makes the budget deficit get worse, which reinforces the loss of confidence, and it turns into a vicious circle. And when things go right, it turns into a virtuous circle. And Brazil has been on a virtuous circle, thank God, for the last several months. It could go wrong. There could be a political blow up. There could be something goes wrong. You know, the Brazilian crisis originally was triggered by the Russian crisis. One of the virtues of teaching introductory economics is that you talk to people who aren't used to these things. And when I said this to my Econ 02 class at MIT, that Brazil's crisis was triggered by events in Russia, they said they thought that was funny or weird, which we've all gotten used to it, but it is in fact extremely weird. And so it could be that there would be a crisis in some entirely unrelated part of the world that would somehow make people think badly of Brazil. Right now it's on a roll, not so much because anything fundamental has changed, as because it's managed to get into a groove of better expectations. I think it's okay, but it's, you don't have to turn any mental somersaults to run the virtuous circle in reverse and make it turn bad again.
Right at the back. Hold on.
Oh yeah, sorry.
You kind of advocated currency boards, and that would be then a national thing, I imagine. How about a global kind of like Tobin tax or something? How do you view that?
Okay, I'm not actually for currency boards. I thought I didn't make that as clear as I should have. I think it's a straitjacket that prevents you from doing certain kinds of harm to yourself, but on the other hand, is in the long run a very unhappy constraint. The Tobin tax, most people probably know, Tobin tax is a tax on international foreign exchange transactions that's supposed to slow up big speculative movements. The trouble with the Tobin tax is it's, at least as described, it's now completely unenforceable because you can't find the foreign exchange transactions. They're taking place somewhere in cyberspace. What is possible is to tax things. Not the foreign exchange transactions, but tax certain kinds of borrowing, certain kinds of lending. It's possible. Put it this way: it's possible to have the kind of tax that Chileans have had, where companies that borrow in foreign currency have to pay a tax, which the way it actually works, it turns out to be a very severe tax on short-term borrowing and trivial if the borrowing is long-term enough. It is still possible to run exchange controls. Not so much because you can stop people from doing foreign exchange transactions as because you can require exporters to surrender foreign exchange, and while they can cheat, it's not that easy. In general, I don't like these things. I would like to have some taxation on foreign currency debt because I think that creates a specific kind of vulnerability. And I'd like to reserve exchange controls as an emergency tool in crisis. But the Tobin taxes, it's one of these things, if you could do it, there would be a pretty good case for it, but you can't.
Having to change all the
short term.
Right. I had no role in the Malaysian decision. At least no direct. I wasn't involved. But clearly, I came out advocating them 2 days before they were actually instituted, and there is some possibility that this may have influenced the actual. Probably not, but it might have tipped the balance. They should be phased out. I would want to see them phased out reasonably quickly because I don't think they're needed at the moment. They were probably not needed, it turns out. It turns out that the panic was subsiding just about the time that the Malaysian government and I were concluding that we needed something to curb the panic. So it turns out they weren't needed. On the other hand, they really have not had any of the disastrous effects that people thought. I suspect that the Malaysian government will want to keep them on longer than they really should, if only to prove that they were right. It's an understandable thing, right? That's not such a terrible thing to do, because they're not terribly binding as it now stands. And there would be enormous pressure. There's propagandizing from the investment community to say you must get these things off of this terrible thing. It was an inconclusive experiment. As it turned out, the thing we learned was that these are not as impractical and as disastrous as people expected, but we didn't get any demonstration that they actually work either, because of the timing. I hope that we don't get a chance to perform the experiment again, but I suspect we will.
Just interested, do you think the euro is a good thing, and should the UK join?
I knew that had to come up. Okay. The short answer is no and yes. Okay, no, it's not a good thing, and probably in the long run, the UK should join. And there's a reason for that. I still think, there are whole legions of ugly Americans on this issue, right? And on the whole issue of the euro, the fundamental problem with the euro is the problem of one size fits all monetary policy, in terms of my terminology earlier, it means giving up the ability to print coupons to keep your babysitting co-op humming smoothly, and that would be not a problem if you had the same events happening to all of the countries in Europe at the same time, absence of asymmetric shocks. But only 6 months in, we've seen that asymmetric shocks are a real and a big issue. Okay, the putative gains from the euro, there are certainly gains in terms of certainty and reduced cost of transactions. The big gain that people like to talk about, which is price transparency, I just have trouble taking seriously. It seems to me that in a world where you can process gigabytes of information in a millisecond, people can multiply and divide, but still, I think that the balance of the economic arguments are probably negative, but not something I go to the barricades for. The problem is that's not the issue that the UK faces. These guys have decided to do it. It's happened. It is, Brussels says, it's legally, it's irreversible. So you can't pull out whatever misquoted remarks Prodi might make. So the question then is whether to join this thing that is going to exist. In the long run, and I can't help, you have to play amateur political analyst here. In the long run, I suspect that the UK would suffer a lot of suffer a lot in ways that would eventually have an economic import from being the outsider. That it would find that decisions on things
from trade policy to competition policy to financial market regulation would be taken in a way that worked against UK interests. The only thing that would, so I would end up saying that I think it's probably a bad idea, but probably given that it's happened in Europe, the UK would want to be part of it all the same, which is an awkward position, but I think, but not a crazy one. The only thing that would worry me is if you think, this all presupposes that the euro is going to be reasonably well managed. Because if what's going to happen is that an excessively conservative ECB that fails to recognize that deflation is as large a risk in the modern world as inflation, which stumbles into a European liquidity trap. If that's what you're talking about joining, then you don't want to be part of it. So what would I do if I was Mr. Blair? What he is doing, which is fudging and temporizing and giving the ECB a chance to prove those ugly Americans wrong before committing yourself to the thing. So that's what I would do. I don't know whether he's like our head of state, who is who is an intuitive genius at somehow fudging and ending up doing basically the right thing, or whether this is a calculated ploy. But anyway, it is what I would be doing.
I think we should probably call a halt there.